the Radiator, 105.9 FM WOMMLP, Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and this is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear an interview with writer, editor, translator, and teacher of creative writing, Wendy Call. She is presently the writer-in-residence at the Marsh Billings Rockefeller National Historical Park of Vermont. She has also been a writer-in-residence at Cornell College of Iowa and the studios of Key West, among other institutions. Her narrative nonfiction book, which is the book we discuss in our interview, is No Word for Welcome, published by University of Nebraska Press. No Word for Welcome explores how economic globalization intersects with village life in a region of southern Mexico called the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. Wendy was a 2000 to 2002 fellow of the Institute of Current World Affairs in the Mexican Isthmus, and that's the setting for No Word for Welcome. She co-edited a book called Telling True Stories, a Nonfiction Writer's Guide from the Nieman Foundation at Harvard University, published by Plume Penguin. She co-edited that with Mark Kramer. Her nonfiction writing and her translations from Spanish of poetry and fiction have appeared in more than 50 magazines and literary journals and in several anthologies. Wendy has worked as a writer and editor since 2000, and before that she devoted a decade to work for social change in organizations in Boston and Seattle. She holds a BA in biology from Oberlin College and an MFA in writing and literature from the Bennington College Writing Seminars right here in Vermont. The daughter of a middle school math teacher and a career Navy officer from rural Michigan, Wendy grew up on and around military bases in Florida, Pennsylvania, Southern California, and Southern Maryland. She currently lives in Seattle and Miami. When I spoke to Wendy, I asked her to talk about how she became interested in Mexico.
Well, I worked for a number of grassroots organizations as a grassroots organizer for the first decade out of college. And then one of the ones that I worked for in the late 1990s, we didn't actually do a lot of organizing in the U.S. We raised money and garnered support for community organizing in other parts of the world. And one of the places where we had partner organizations was in Mexico, and that got me really interested in what was happening with people in Mexico organizing specifically around issues of the economy and how people in Mexico were dealing at that time with NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which was new, and other aspects of changes in the global economy.
Right. Okay. And what I found fascinating in the book was to see how these villagers took in that information and understood it in their own world and kind of figured out how to live within that change that was coming or to fight the change that was coming, you know, and it was just an interesting other perspective to, you know, what we read about in the New York Times every week or something, how these villagers are actually processing all of this information and moving forward.
Yes. One of the things I found really interesting was how sophisticated people were in thinking about it and how deeply they thought about themselves as part of a global economy. I remember on one of my first visits to the part of Mexico that I ended up writing the book about in 1998, I ended up, to my great surprise, being interviewed for a radio station there in southern Mexico.
Oh.
And one of the first questions the interviewer asked me, because I was there sort of a representative of the public opinion in the United States, was, "So when are your people going to stop driving your SUVs so that we stop having these horrible impacts from global warming?" And this was 1998, when people didn't talk that much about global warming. And this was one of the first questions he had for me as somebody visiting from the U.S.
Was he interviewing you in Spanish?
Yes.
Were you already fluent in Spanish much earlier than you moved to the Isthmus of Tehuantepec?
No, I wasn't fluent, and I would say I'm still not fluent. I mean, honestly, I think in the U.S. where we tend to be fairly monolingual compared to, say, most people who live in Europe or even many people who live in Asia and African countries, I'm still not completely fluent. I mean, I work as a translator and I've done some work as an interpreter, but, you know, I'm definitely a much stronger English speaker than I am a Spanish speaker. But no, in 1998, my Spanish was basic, but, for example, I had to record interviews because I couldn't trust myself to listen, process, and take notes at the same time.
Right.
So I recorded all my interviews, and then often when I was going back over them to transcribe them, or in some cases I had had someone else transcribe them and I was reading them, the Spanish transcripts, I realized that my questions didn't really make sense because I didn't understand deeply what the person was saying to me until I was listening to it for the second or third time.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
So the proficiency in Spanish came over a period of many years.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what inspired you to actually write the book, No Word for Welcome?
I started out writing a series of articles. What really interested me, I didn't think of myself as a writer, although when I was a child I had really wanted to be a writer. I had discarded that idea by about ninth grade as completely unreasonable way to try and earn one's living. And so
Which was true.
And continues to be true, but I think I've realized that I wish I had not forced myself to be so practical at such a young age.
Right.
So I wasn't thinking of myself as having a writing project. I was sort of thinking of it as an inquiry into the profession that I had chosen, which was grassroots organizing. And I felt that here in the U.S. in the late 90s, I didn't really feel particularly creative or effective in the work that I was doing here, and so I wanted to see how people in a very different kind of community and culture organized themselves and worked on collective issues. Mm-hmm. And this was the place that I ended up choosing. And so I was writing articles partly to be able to have enough money to continue to go back and visit the region. And then I received a grant that allowed me to go and live there for 2 years. And the agreement for the grant was that I had to produce a long article every month that the foundation then published. And once I had produced several of these, I realized, you know, I think I'm really writing a book here.
Mm-hmm.
Although that was a decade ago, and it took me another decade to actually create the book and get it out into the world.
Right. Well, it's one thing to decide, oh, I'm going to write a book, and it's another thing to decide, I'm going to write a book that requires a great deal of research and understanding and history and all of that.
Yes.
All right, so I wanted to ask, how might you describe the land area, the isthmus of Tehuantepec, to someone who's never been there?
Well, it's often a place that people have never heard of, although over a century ago in the late 1800s, it was much better known in the United States because at that time, there was a time at which the U.S. government actually thought about buying it and making it part of the United States, not long after all of northern Mexico became what we now think of as the southwest of the United States.
Uh-huh.
So if you were to travel directly south from Mobile, Alabama, across the Gulf of Mexico, the first piece of land you would hit is the Isthmus of Tehuantepec, and it's what connects the Yucatan Peninsula and Central America to the rest of Mexico. And it's actually runs east-west, not north-south.
Mm-hmm.
So the eastern end of it is the states of Tabasco and Chiapas, the latter being sort of better known to people in the U.S., and then the western end of it is parts of the states of Oaxaca and Veracruz in Mexico.
Okay. All right. And what about what you might see if you were visiting there? I know that you've said that Frida Kahlo's style came largely from this area of the country. So how would you describe the food and the style of the people and the buildings, things like that?
Well, it's mostly a rural region, although it does have a number of cities that have around 100,000 people in them. And so you don't see huge buildings. I mean, there are very few buildings that are more than, say, 3 stories tall. It's very green. The region mm-hmm. of the isthmus that I lived in was actually called the humid zone because it rains so much there. So most of it is a fairly low-lying area. So it's very green, very wet, and very, very hot. But in spite of that, the traditional outfits that women wear, now they wear them more to fiestas and special occasions, are embroidered tunics, short crop tunics, which if you've seen pretty much any photograph or painting of Frida Kahlo, she's wearing one of these. And they're made out of velvet, which is
wow.
not the most logical fabric for a place where it's usually in the 90s or over 100 degrees. And the reason that they're made out of velvet is because the Isthmus of Tehuantepec has been a transit zone for so long. When the Spaniards first arrived there in the 1519, they first arrived there. What they were looking for was a way to cross this landmass so that they could get to Asia. And the Isthmus of Tehuantepec was a great place to do that. So the reason that women even today wear embroidered velvet tunics is because it's been a transit zone between China and Western Europe for so long. Women in France were wearing velvet, and the women in the Isthmus thought that looked really fashionable, and they started doing it too.
Oh, that's great. I wanted to talk a little bit about a person with whom you worked quite a bit in your time in the Isthmus, and that's Carlos Beas. I wonder if you could talk about who he is and how you met him.
He was the first person that I met the first time I arrived in the Mexican Isthmus, and I had gone there to attend a three-day conference that was happening in response to rumors that were floating around that there was a huge industrial development plan for this part of Mexico that was going to build new factories and build new highways and really fundamentally change the way people earned their living. Most of the people in the Isthmus work in the primary economy, which is to say they are fisher folk and farmers. Now there are more people that work in some industrial factories there. There's a cement factory, there's an oil refinery. So it's not completely rural life, but it is still largely rural life. Mm-hmm. And so the organization that Carlos Beas worked for, that he co-founded, was holding a meeting where people could come and talk about what are these plans that we've heard rumors of and what should we do about them since they're going to fundamentally change the place that we live. Mm-hmm. And I showed up at his house with the people who had brought me there from the city late one night. The conference was starting in the morning. Carlos Beas was sick with dengue, which is a common and extremely unpleasant illness that you get from mosquitoes. And in spite of being absolutely sick as a dog, he welcomed us into his house, made us breakfast the next morning, and then we all went off to this conference where 1,000 people, mostly from the Isthmus, but also people from other parts of Mexico, were getting together to make a plan for what do we do about all of these rumors that we're hearing. And he was the one who coordinated this entire conference.
And the rumors were about the Trans-Isthmus mega project, is that correct?
Exactly, yeah. Exactly.
So can you describe all of the, I mean, it was a huge project, or the plan originally was extremely big. I wonder if you can talk about a few of the things that was going to do to the area.
It was a huge multifaceted project, and when it was first announced, although really only announced to people in Mexico City, to people within government and industrial sectors, and to people outside of Mexico, it was not announced in any way to the people who actually lived in the Isthmus of Tehuantepec. But the list of proposed projects included everything from industrial shrimp farms, where you cut down the mangrove forest, put in huge cement tanks, and grow shrimp at an industrial scale. Eucalyptus tree plantations, where you get rid of the native vegetation, or in some cases people's cropland, and you replace it with eucalyptus trees, which are an exotic tree. They're not from this continent. And then you build a paper pulp facility to then pulp those trees and make them into paper. There was a plan to develop a new highway network that would connect the Gulf of Mexico to the Pacific Ocean so that they could continue to use the Isthmus as a transit corridor between the east coast of the U.S. and Western Europe and Asia, and particularly China. Now, these roads, which might not sound like much of a problem, were really not welcomed by the people who lived in this region. The plans were not welcomed because they would be toll roads, which would mean that the people who live there wouldn't be able to afford to use them, and they would be sort of U.S.-style interstates, meaning that you couldn't walk from one side to another, just like you can't walk across an interstate, and they were going to be going through villages, so people who don't have vehicles would have their homes on one side and their fields or their schools on the other side, and it wasn't clear how they would be able to get around in their daily life.
Yeah, that was the thing that really shocked me. Just, and I suppose it has to do with the geographical layout of that part of the country, but that they were actually going to split people's properties in two and not make any sort of adjustments to help people get to work in the morning. I mean, it was just, that shocked me.
Yes. mean, these are rural communities, and there was really a strong sense among the people who were creating this plan, several of whom I interviewed and
right.
spoke with, that the way that these people in the isthmus were earning their living, being fishermen, being farmers, was really an outmoded way to earn your living, and really the best thing for these people, although they weren't going to ask them whether they thought it was a good idea,
right.
was for them to leave their land and to go to work in factories. So I really do believe that a number of the people who were part of creating this plan really believed they had the best interest of the people who live in the isthmus at heart, that the best thing to do was to get them off the land into factory jobs, and in order to build those factories, you had to build these roads.
Mm-hmm. Now, the fact that they weren't sharing this information directly with the villagers, and there was a part in the book where you actually got a hold of some aspect of the plans and maps that they had requested over and over and over and had not been able to get a hold of, and you were, you know, sort of a stranger to the area and walked in and were able to get these. So, I mean, did they just make the assumption that these people wouldn't be sophisticated enough to be a part of this, or is that terribly cynical on my part?
It is cynical, but I think it might also be true. I would ask people, there were multiple times that I was able to get access to information that people who actually live where these plans were going to be carried out had asked for and were unable to get, or in some cases they were given inadequate or inaccurate information. And I think that generally speaking, the people who were making these plans had not thought that much about the people that lived in the region and what they might want or what their opinions might be. There was really a paternal sense that the folks that worked in Mexico City, the folks that ran the big design companies and worked in the government agencies, knew what was best, and that those people who lived in the villages would just come along.
Mm-hmm.
I remember once asking the person who was the primary architect of this whole plan. He had put together the whole 500-page document that I eventually was able to get a copy of, why it was that people in the isthmus, when they heard about these plans, were criticizing them and in many cases opposed to them. And he said, well, they haven't been briefed properly.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a very strong sense that they wouldn't have their own valid opinions, that they needed to be told what they should think about what was proposed for their own lands and villages.
Now, was that individual a person named Felipe Ochoa?
Yes, that
Is
was
that
Felipe
who
Ochoa,
that?
Who appears in my book.
He does, yeah. Now, he was largely responsible for the plan, or largely responsible maybe for some of the initial ideas for the plan. And at one point he says to you, in Mexico, nothing happens until it happens, and when it happens, everything happens. I thought that was a great statement. I wondered if you could speak to that statement and what that meant to you at the time.
Yes. I have to say that I quite liked Felipe Ochoa as an individual. I
mm-hmm.
Interviewed him on the phone and then once visited his office. And he was one of the people that really seemed to me that in his mind he was doing what was best
mm-hmm.
for the people that lived in this region. It was just from the world that he came from, those people were never people that you would go and talk to.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he thought he was absolutely baffled by the idea that I was actually going to go to this region and visit it and talk to people as part of a project of writing about what was going to happen in the region. You know,
mm-hmm.
his attitude was, well, all the information is in Mexico City. Why don't you just stay here? You know, Mexico City is 500 kilometers away from the isthmus. But he did have really interesting perspectives on Mexican culture. He had lived in the U.S. and been a professor at MIT for a number of years, so he really knew what U.S. culture was like, and he was one of those people, like Carlos Baez, who could really bridge these two cultures. So I
mm-hmm.
found him quite interesting. And one of the things he was really good at was explaining to people in the U.S. things that seemed very odd or quirky about Mexico. And one of the things that people from the U.S. often complain about is that things happen at the last minute in Mexico,
yeah.
that it seems that there are no plans being made, and then suddenly everything comes together, and it doesn't matter that we didn't make plans weeks or months in advance. And I found that statement to be particularly true just in my daily life living in Mexico, that I kept thinking, we need to get our act together. We need to get this plan together. We need to figure out what we're doing. And everyone would say, oh, there's tons of time. And they were absolutely right, that things needed to happen. They did happen, but we didn't need to do a lot of rigmarole organizing them in advance.
Now, do you think living there changed your internal clock? Has your pace changed at all in the way you live your life now?
Yeah, I tend to be someone who has a lot of things going on, and one of the nicknames that people gave me when I lived in Mexico is Remolino, which means whirlwind or a little dust devil.
Okay.
And I thought that that was quite appropriate, because essentially what it means is that there's a lot of activity, but there's not necessarily a lot of forward movement.
Right.
And one of the things that I found that Mexican rhythms tend to do well is figure out how to actually have the forward movement without having a lot of just spinning one's wheels.
Mm-hmm.
So I think one of the things that's changed for me, you know, since I've come back to the United States, is learning how to be patient about things, and also having a different sense of long time frames. One of the things that people in the Isthmus would say to me a lot is, globalization has been around for a long time. We're going to be around for longer. We really just need to wait this out.
Hmm.
And because many of these people have lived in the region of Mexico that they live in for literally thousands of years, there are some of these villages that can trace their history back in the Isthmus 5,000 years. And the people considered the newcomers can trace their history back between 200 and 700 years, they have a much different sense of what a long time means. And as much as that's not the way we think about things in the U.S., being a very young country by comparison, I have really tried to adopt that in terms of thinking about the long term and not being worried that what's happening today is going to change everything.
Yeah, yeah. That seems a little tangentially related to this other thing that I loved in the book, which was the distinction between what they called Hora de Dios and the Hora de Zedillo.
Yes.
That seems so perfect in describing the individualism of the villagers, too, which I wonder if you can just explain that.
Well, those are ways of referring to daylight savings time. And not daylight savings time. Hora de Zedillo. Zedillo was the president of Mexico at the time that they decided that Mexico needed to follow daylight savings time. And the reason this was decided was that NAFTA had been put into place, and they wanted Mexico to be on the same time zone that the central United States was all year round. Now, in southern Mexico, it's far enough south that there's not a huge difference in day length in winter and summer, and so there isn't any real reason for daylight savings time.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of the villages just refused to go along with it, which mm-hmm. made things like getting on a bus very confusing.
Right.
And they would talk about these different time periods during the months of daylight savings time. If you were talking about daylight savings time, you said Hora de Zedillo, Zedillo's time. And if you were talking about non-daylight savings time, you would say Hora de Dios, or God's time.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Depending on who you were talking to, you had to know based on that person's sort of political and philosophical outlook. If they told you 6 o'clock, were they talking about God's time or the president's time?
Although maybe it didn't matter that much, because people were pretty loose on time anyway, is that right?
Right. It really only mattered if you needed to get on a bus.
Okay, that's great. Well, Wendy, maybe this would be a good time to read a couple pages from No Word for Welcome.
Sure.
And I'll just mention that No Word for Welcome is published by the University of Nebraska Press.
So I'm going to read from the end of the introduction to the book, the last page and a half of the introduction. On a map painted in 1580 by an indigenous cartographer, words in calligraphic script tell the Spanish crown about its colonial lands. In English, the Southern Sea, the Soconusco trading route to Guatemala, and more mountains. The Pacific Ocean undulates along the left margin of the map, and along the right, the cartographer has painted a mountain range. In spite of all the words, the artist has used a pictogram to title the map. At the peak of a hill, towering over the spires of a Catholic church, a spotted jaguar crouches. The image means Tehuantepec, or Hill of the Jaguar, the name given to the region by the Aztecs. Spanish nobles gazing at this map would not have recognized that symbol placed squarely in the center. I smile at the inferred message from the local cartographer to the far-off Spanish government. You might think you own this, but you don't even know what it's called. On this map, landforms flow from one to another, connected by watercolor rivers. Tiny footprints mark narrow paths. Hoofprints mark wider wagon paths. There are no property lines, no borders, no fences. The only boundary is where land meets sea. Andrés Inestrosa, one of Mexico's great 20th century writers and an indigenous Zapotec, came from a small isthmus town. He writes of his home place. It's small. It fits in the palm of the hand. It doesn't weigh heavily on the shoulders, yet it overflows the heart. I have fashioned my map of the Isthmus of Tehuantepec in the form of a book. It is not an easy choice because text implies story, a narrative that stretches out on a straight, unbroken line from beginning to end. But like a map, the story is not linear. It is two-dimensional, extending in many directions at once. Just as every map is provisional, so is this story. It is a story of people pushing back against globalization, even as they participate in it. It is a story of people refusing to accept spilled oil seeping into soil, pavement rolling where forest once stood, pollution draining into sparkling lagoons. These menos, who sustain a livelihood from brackish waters, coax crops out of black earth, and dig roots from the forest floor, are staving off destruction with their words and their actions by mere dint of their continued existence. They do this anonymously, endlessly. The moment they stop, the road will be built, the forest felled, the lagoon poisoned. The story will have reached its bitter end. And so this story stretches out like a road toward the horizon, beyond the covers of this book, disappearing into the mist of the future.
Thank you very much for reading that. Did you write that before you wrote the book, or did you write that after you wrote the book?
I kept writing it over and over throughout the whole process. You know, the introduction to the book, I think I wrote about 24 introductions.
Yeah, yeah.
And
sure.
Actually, when I think about that particular section, the quote from Andrés Inestrosa,
right.
who is a writer who's really a legend in Mexico. He lived to be over 100 years old, and he started writing when he was quite young. So he was an incredible writer in that he was writing throughout the 20th century.
Mm.
And when I read that he had said that about his village, and he was an interesting person in that he left the Isthmus when he was quite young, moved to Mexico City, really never went home, and often said kind of disparaging things about the town that he was from and
oh.
the rural area that he was
oh, no.
from. And so when I found this, I realized, oh, he actually, in his heart of hearts, really loved it.
Yeah.
But that quote I came across very early in my process of researching the book, and I knew that that was going to somehow be in the introduction because I thought that for all of the terrible things that Andrés Inestrosa had said about his hometown, that that was really, you know, lovely and true about the whole region. So different parts of the introduction kind of accreted over time, but I know that that quote came very early, and then as I continued to do the research, the map that I mentioned from 1580 is a map that I had heard about a lot. It's a very famous map, and so I had been sort of collecting what people had to say about it, and then finally, very late in the process of writing the book, I think maybe a year before the manuscript was actually finished, I was able to go and visit the library where this map is kept. It's at the University of Texas in Austin, which interestingly has one of the largest collections of material about Latin America anywhere on this continent.
Mm.
And I spent a whole day looking at this map and writing about it and thinking about it, and so that portion came very close to the end of the process of writing the book.
Interesting. And you collected maps the whole time that you were there. You say that early on, that you were very interested in the various maps of both the area and history and the plan that was being put forward. So I was curious if you used the maps at all to figure out how you wanted to structure your own work. I know that your metaphorical reference was that this was your map, but I'm curious if it went beyond metaphor. Did you use your maps at all towards structure?
I did use them a lot for structure. I've always been obsessed with maps from the time I can remember. The two first documents I remember being interested in as a very small child were the newspaper, because it was what I saw my parents reading at the breakfast table back in those days when we read newspapers at breakfast, and maps, because whenever my family went anywhere, the maps were clearly the most important document that were going to get us there.
Uh-huh.
So even before I could read, I remember the first two things I wanted to know how to read were maps and newspapers.
Uh-huh.
And so when I first went to the Isthmus, one of the things I found very interesting is that, generally speaking, Mexicans don't use maps very much, particularly in rural areas. People tend to just memorize the places that they need to go. Mm-hmm. And often, even if they're literate, they don't really know how to use a map because they don't use them much. In the cities, obviously, especially in Mexico City, maps are quite crucial. But in rural areas, I hardly ever saw people looking at maps, although they would draw maps in the sand or on a piece of paper to explain things to mm-hmm. me. Mm-hmm. And I found these maps very fascinating because they were all an individual person's idea of what a space meant, not necessarily what a cartographer would think a space should look like or how it should be represented. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So I got very interested in maps as how people recorded their experience of a place. Yeah. And one of the very first times that I went to the Isthmus, it was with a group of people from Mexico City, none of whom knew where they were going. And it was nighttime, and we were lost. And I pulled out a road map, and they were all completely shocked. It had not occurred to them that we could use a road map to figure out where we were going. And I told them where we should go, and they were absolutely amazed that this person who had only been to the Isthmus once before was actually able to navigate to this place, because in their minds, you are able to navigate a place if you have actually lived it.
Hmm.
So there's a way in which a map is an abstraction, and the way that people use maps there was not by pulling out a road map and figuring out how to get to a town from wherever you were. It was showing something that was already in your experience and in your heart, and you were representing it for someone else.
Mm-hmm.
And so for me, I remember when I started this book, this was sort of before the age of hyperlinked text, because I started this project in the 90s.
Yeah.
And I think that maybe if I were doing the project now, it wouldn't actually be a print book. It would be some kind of hyperlinked map, because I really did think that that struggle that I mentioned in the introduction, that narrative has to be linear, made it very hard for me to make this story that I wanted to tell into a book, because it's not a linear story,
mm-hmm.
and it's a multinodal story. One of the big struggles I had was cutting down the number of villages that I talk about in the book, because I visited dozens upon dozens, and editors and then the woman who eventually became my agent kept telling me, you need to tell the whole story about one village. Which, as you know, I did not do. There's mm-hmm. about a half a dozen villages, and there's three that figure quite prominently. But the idea of cutting it down to one was inconceivable to me, even though I understand that for a book, that might have made the most sense.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Although reading the book, from my perspective, I didn't feel at all lost, you know, floundering among all these various villages. It was very interesting to see the various cultures that are all represented in this area. And you know, the people speak many languages. You know, it's not just all one language in the Isthmus. How many are there, do you know?
Well, there are 10. And then the number is a little bit hard to pin down, because there are new groups of native people from other parts of Mexico that have come to the Isthmus recently because they've, for various reasons, had to leave where they live. There's a group of about 50,000 people who live in the Isthmus who are Chinantec, and the reason they live there is because the Mexican government in the 70s built dams in the part mm-hmm. of Oaxaca that they lived in, and they were all, like, forcibly relocated to the Isthmus.
Mm.
And the Chinantecs, they are from three different sort of small regions, and the language that they speak, although we call it all Chinantec, it actually has some very different variants that are as different as, say, Spanish and Italian. And
okay.
So to call it all one language is not quite correct, because people who speak High Chinantec and Low Chinantec might not be able to understand each other.
Oh, that's really interesting. Did you learn any of those languages while you were there, or did everyone speak Spanish with you?
Most of the people who I spoke to spoke Spanish. Generally, people, 40s and younger in the villages that I was in spoke Spanish. And I learned sort of isolated words and phrases from different languages. But because I was traveling around a lot and I was with people from very different communities, it would have been a very different project if I had decided, okay, I'm going to learn Ombeats or Mije or Zapotec and really focus on that. I would have been staying in one place more.
Mm-hmm.
And And honestly, I was struggling enough with Spanish, it seemed like a sort of absurd proposition.
Right. Yeah.
These languages are also very different from each other because these people moved to the isthmus at different points in history. There are languages that are very radically different from each other. I now realize that if I had decided to really stay in the city of Juchitán and learn Zapotec, that would have been a reasonable prospect over a number of years because Zapotec is actually grammatically in some ways more similar to English than it is to Spanish. On the other side, it's a tonal language, and tonal languages are notoriously difficult for adults to learn.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
People who learn them as adults tend to sound kind of silly when they speak them. But most people spoke to me in Spanish, and then when I was speaking to elders, or in some cases when I went to villages that were a little more remote, and adults, particularly women, would not speak Spanish, I always had someone who would translate for me.
Okay. Now, I'm curious if the people who speak these different languages have, you know, deeply different cultures as well. You know, I'm thinking about the different regions of Spain and how each of those regions is so unique and proud, and if that's similar.
It is similar, and they have, like the different regions of Spain or other European countries, they have really long, fraught, complex histories. So some of, you know, these communities of people that we're now lumping together as Ismeños, and they also sort of collectively refer to themselves as Ismeños, or people from the isthmus, you know, hundreds of years ago, they had long and bitter battles over land and who had access to certain land. There are groups that were sort of known for having oppressed other groups and taken away their land and treated them very badly. Also, these different groups had very different relationships with the Aztecs. Some of them were allied with the Aztecs, some of them were bitter foes of the Aztecs, and then those relationships often continued under the Spanish crown. The relationship that they had when the Spaniards first came to the Spanish tended to be similar to the relationship they had had to the Aztecs, which is to say very, very complex. So one of the things that can be really touchy is that sometimes people will confuse people from different groups, call someone Zapotec who's not Zapotec, they're Wave, mm-hmm. and that's a fairly major error to make because those groups have a very long and complex and at times fraught history with each other.
Right. And when you identify yourself by whether you've been in this part of Mexico for 5,000 years or 700 years, certainly these things are still going to be very fresh for you.
Absolutely, absolutely.
So, yeah.
But at the same time, there is a strong sense of being people of the isthmus and having that in common, so much so that in some of the villages, the way the language works, there's a word for outsider that can mean everything from someone from Mexico City to someone from Spain to someone from the United States. That all that matters, you're either from the isthmus or you're not from the isthmus, and that's the important distinction between groups of people.
It seemed to me while I was reading the book that soldiers were everywhere, you know, guarding everything, whether or not they were doing a very good job of it or they were just playing cards. But why were soldiers everywhere? Does it feel like you're in a police state?
Well, this was at the time that I was living there, and most of the time that the narrative of the book takes place, which is from 1997 to 2003, and then there's a little bit at the end that goes up to 2008. At that time, that was really during the height of the conflict between mm-hmm. the Zapatistas in Chiapas, which is right next door, and the Mexican government. And that conflict continues, but it was more heavily militarized in the late 1990s and up until 2000-2001. And so part of the militarization was from that. Part of it is that this is a region that a lot of drugs travel through from
right.
South America up to the United States.
Sure.
And the Mexican military is both supposedly controlling that and then also in other ways quite heavily involved in the drug trade. But it's also a region that there's always been this sense that it's a region that needs to be controlled. The isthmus has declared independence from Mexico or from the states that the territory belongs to a number of times. And so there is a fairly strong military presence there for that reason. And then the final reason is that it's also because it's a little land bridge, and the only way to get by land from Central America to the United States. There are many, many Central Americans traveling through this region to come to the United States for work, and the Mexican military is there to catch them and send them back to the country that they're from.
Okay. Were they an amicable presence for the most part?
It really varied. I would not call them amicable. In any case, there were some villages that just sort of grudgingly accepted that there was a military outpost on the edge of town. There were some villages that were very resentful of it, but sort of quietly resentful. And then on the other side of it, there were also a lot of young men from the Isthmus who joined the military. Like in the United States, you know, the most of the people who go into the U.S. military and go to Iraq and Afghanistan these days are from rural areas. And it's similar in Mexico, where if you're not able to earn a living from your farm, which is increasingly the case, and you don't have a formal education because there's no high school anywhere near where you live, you don't really have a lot of career options, and the military is one of them.
Yeah.
And a couple of the groups that live in this region have a really sort of long and proud history as warrior people, which is how they refer to themselves, that they are very proud of the fact that they, rather than collaborate with the Aztecs and with the Spanish, they just moved up into the mountains and continued to live as they've always lived. One of these groups, the Mije people, say, we were never conquered by the Spanish, and we were never conquered by the Aztecs. We've always lived on our own. And interestingly, perhaps ironically, a fairly large portion of young men from these Mije communities end up becoming soldiers and joining the military because that's part of their cultural identity.
You co-edited a book on writing nonfiction, Telling True Stories, A Nonfiction Writer's Guide. And I'm just curious if you find yourself turning to that book for guidance in your own projects.
I did for a long time, and there's a way in which what's in the book might have in part been shaped by what I felt that I needed in my own writing projects, because that book didn't begin as a book. It began as a conference that used to be offered every year, sponsored by Harvard University in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And the person who co-edited that book with me, whose project it was originally, Mark Kramer, was the person who had founded this conference.
Mm-hmm.
And so he decided he was interested in putting together an anthology, asked me to work on it with him, and then the first thing that we did was went through a half dozen years of audio recordings of all of these conference sessions, all of these workshops and lectures, and decided what was actually interesting and important and of general interest enough that it should go into an anthology.
Yeah.
And this was happening at the same time that I was working on the early stages of the book and figuring out the arc of the story and figuring out what villages would be included and what villages would get left out. And so there was a way in which the creation of Telling True Stories happened at the same time that the creation of No Word for Welcome did, and I'm sure that there was some influence in what I needed as a writer were things that I gravitated toward. And then we did go through a process where we had other people read sections of the manuscript when it was in development and tell us what they thought was missing and what they thought we were emphasizing too much.
Mm-hmm.
And so we were essentially working from raw transcripts of audio sessions and then slicing and dicing them and chopping them up and reconfiguring them into individual essays. And in some cases, that editorial process was so intense that when we sent it to the author, they would say, I don't really remember saying this. I mean, it does sound like me, and I do agree with what's being said, but I really don't remember that I said this. And partly that was because a number of years had passed, and partly it was because in some cases, as often happens, the most interesting part of a conference session had come out of the question and answer.
Oh, sure.
And so we had edited in sections that were coming from a question and answer session that weren't part of the speaker's, you know, prepared remarks.
Sometimes the most spontaneous and fun stuff comes out of the Q&A.
Absolutely. And from the speaker's perspective, I know from when I give talks, I don't remember what I say during the Q&A because I'm so focused on what is the person's question and am I answering it,
yeah,
that right. I could really understand why later the authors would say, I don't really remember having said that, although it does sort of sound like me.
Yeah. I wondered what writers you would say have influenced you, either personally or through reading their works.
In terms of reading their works, there are many, many, many. I mean, I was thinking about the fact that when I'm asked this question, that could be the whole interview. And I think that's probably true with most authors, that really what we are first is readers. And
yeah.
Alon Stavins, who is a writer who I admire a lot, who is incredibly prolific. Alon Stavins publishes about a book a year and has for decades. He talks about how he thinks of himself as a writer second and a reader first, which I think is really interesting for someone who's so prolific. But in terms of writers that had a huge influence on No Word for Welcome and on my thinking and motivation for creating the book, one of them is Luis Alberto Urrea, who is a Mexican-American writer who writes in all genres, which is one of the things I find most incredible because I am very strictly a nonfiction writer only. But he's a playwright and a poet and a short story writer and a journalist and a novelist. And he writes really, really beautifully about the merging of cultures that happens between what we now call the United States and what we now call Mexico. So his books have been really inspirational to me. Eduardo Galeano, who is from Uruguay, and is just in the last few years becoming better known in the U.S. and most recently was a little better known in the U.S. because Chavez, the president of Venezuela, gave President Obama a copy of one of Galeano's first books, which is still one of the ones he's best known for, called The Open Veins of Latin America, which is about the different ways that colonialism has shaped and functioned in Latin America over, you know, centuries. But I have to say, Open Veins of Latin America is not one of Eduardo Galeano's best books, which is what he says himself. He says, I didn't even know how to write then. I was an editor. It was my first book. And now he is really, I think, one of the best writers working who is available in English in the world today. And his most recent books, Voices in Time and Mirrors, are the two most recent ones that are available in English, are really incredible in how they condense huge histories down to just a few words. Each of his pieces now almost reads like a prose poem, but it's about some huge moment in history, or sometimes he's writing more now about biological diversity and the natural world. And then another writer who had a huge influence on my thinking about the isthmus is Elena Poniatowska, who is a Mexican writer of Polish and French descent. She is actually literally a Polish princess whose family immigrated to Mexico. And she's written dozens and dozens of books. I believe at this point she's written more than 40 books, only a small number of which are available in English. But she's written several books about this part of Mexico, and she is a journalist and a novelist and someone who's just written a huge range of work. And one of the things I find incredible about her work is that she includes a huge amount of research and then writes a book that really reads like a novel.
Yeah.
What the book that she's best known for in the U.S. is Here's to You, Jesusa, which is quite an incredible book.
Okay. All right. Great. So Wendy, I'm wondering, what are you working on these days?
Well, right now I am in Vermont. I've been here for the last month. I have another almost month left. And I'm beginning a new project writing about national parks and the role that they play in our national identity and what it means to be American.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I got very interested in when I was living in Mexico was the different way that Native communities have been treated there. You know, yes, they were dispossessed of their land. Yes, they suffered and continue to suffer horrible oppression. But they continue to, in a lot of ways, to have more autonomy and more rights than a lot of Native people in the United States do. And most people in Mexico are very familiar with the history of Native communities in Mexico and understand how important their cultures are in what constitutes Mexican identity. In the U.S., I think we're much more likely to not think about Native people anymore.
Mm-hmm.
You even hear things like, well, we are a nation of immigrants. We're all immigrants. And it's true that most of us are immigrants, but some of us aren't. Some of us were already here when the immigrants came.
Mm-hmm.
And to me, the national parks are a really huge part of that history, in that I spent my childhood going around to all the national parks in the West. I grew up in the West. And as far as I was concerned, those were beautiful, pristine places that had never had any people living in them. Well, the truth is that it was mostly native land, and we told the native people they had to leave, and then we made it into a park.
Mm.
So I'm very interested in how our sense of the National Park Service and how that relates to our sense of place, particularly as Americans, relates to the history of this
mm-hmm.
country.
Oh, that's interesting.
And so I'm working at a national park here in Vermont, the first and so far only National Historical Park in Woodstock, Vermont, and then I'm hoping over the next couple of years to visit parks in all four corners of the U.S., since I've lived in all four corners of the U.S., and see what I find.
Oh, that's really interesting. Are you going to start writing a lot about hurricanes now while you're here?
Well, the thing that's interesting is, yes, now I have been in Woodstock through what I guess is the worst disaster, naturally related disaster, although there's certainly a human component to it in climate change, that's happened probably in my lifetime,
mm-hmm.
And I'm in my 40s. And so it has been really interesting, because one of the aspects of my project that I'm interested in is how people work together or don't work together when difficult things happen,
mm-hmm.
which is really one of the themes of No Word for Welcome, was how did the people in these villages react to a huge change in their lives. And I have to say, Woodstock has been really incredible. Very, very generous, and people pulling together, and people just trooping down to the village green to use the porta potties because we don't have running water.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's interesting to me that I've met more people in Woodstock in the 4 days since the flood than I had in the months that I was here previously.
That's really interesting.
Yes.
All right, so I just have one last question for you, Wendy, and that is, what advice do you have for writers who are working to bring attention to a good cause but are doing so as visitors, you know, looking from the outside in?
I think that's it's a really excellent question, as all of your questions have been. It's been really fun to think about aspects of the book that I haven't necessarily been asked about before. And I think that this is a really hard one. In what I had to do in my own experience with this issue was just realize that what I was doing was a huge act of hubris, which one could argue all writing is, as many authors have argued. But to write about some other people and to write about a situation that is not your own situation is an even greater act of hubris.
Mm-hmm.
And there's this great comment that is quoted over and over about travel writing, because some people put what I do in the category of travel writing. But this quote that I find very interesting is, if you are going to write about a place, it is best to stay less than 2 weeks or more than 20 years.
Mm.
And I think that's really true, that a couple of times, or more than a couple of times, during the time I was living in Mexico, in order to earn some freelance income, I would go someplace and spend a week or maybe 2 weeks and then write an article about it. And I found that much easier than writing about the place where I was actually living. And the longer I stayed there, the harder it became for me to write about it, because, as always happens in an educational process, most of the education process is realizing all the things you don't know.
Yeah, yeah. Do you think it had to do also with attachment?
I think it did later, in the sense that you realize what the implications are of writing about people you know, the same kind of struggle that people have when they write memoir.
Mm-hmm,
After I finished my book about Mexico and before I started this new project about national parks, I was writing essays that were really sort of short memoirs. And so I came to understand that agony of writing about family members and your fear of exposing things that people don't want exposed.
Sure.
And of course, you start to feel that about people who are your friends. But it really was more this sense of, the more I got to know the isthmus, the more complex it was, and the more I realized I didn't really know anything
mm-hmm.
about it.
Right.
And
right.
So I think as a writer, it's important to not let that shut you down and to really acknowledge your own inquiry as part of the process. And maybe that comes out on the page and you explain to the reader how it is that you came to know something, or you explain all of the different possible explanations for a phenomenon that you want to talk about. You include different people's opinions. I think one of the weaknesses of a lot of travel writing is that it's too much about the traveler and not enough about the actual perspectives of the people who live in the place.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I started to notice in my own writing, and then noticed it was absolutely rife when people write about a place they're not from, is that the piece of writing begins with an arrival scene, where the person is traveling on some bad road or in some rickety airplane and lands somewhere, arrives somewhere, and describes the landscape as it's rolling by, and then you finally arrive at this very, very isolated place.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But of course, for the people who live there, they don't live in an isolated place. They live in a center, just as someone who lives in New York does.
Sure.
So I think it's really important, you know, when you're writing about things that are outside of, you know, the place that you grew up, to think about how the perspective of the people that you're writing about, that they don't live in the margins, they don't live in an isolated place. You come from an isolated place, and it took you a long time to get to their place, which is a center for them.
That's really interesting, because it's really the difference about of whether you're writing about them as the subject, or are you really writing memoir and their cause is part of your universe. That's a really interesting idea that you have to think about before you set out.
Right, and realize that, of course, you're never going to be able to represent anyone else's story but your own. In the end, no matter how much you try and step out of yourself, it's still your version of a story, who's mm-hmm. ever... story it is.
Right. Well, Wendy Call, I really enjoyed speaking with you. Your book, No Word for Welcome, The Mexican Village Faces the Global Economy, and that's by published by University of Nebraska Press. I really enjoyed reading your book and talking to you. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you so much for reading, and thanks for having me. It's been a really lovely conversation.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Wendy Call. You can learn more about her work at her website, wendycall.com. This week's Write the Book prompt was suggested by my guest, Wendy Call. It's a two-step writing exercise. First, think about a place that you really love. Describe this wonderful place using as few adjectives and adverbs as possible to someone who's never been anywhere like it. Include how it looks, how it sounds, how it smells, as well as the quality of the air and light. And then next, imagine that this place has somehow been destroyed. And then rewrite your description with that terrible knowledge. Good luck with this exercise, and please listen next week for another. If you're interested in sharing this show with out-of-town friends, let them know they can stream it live at theradiator.org every Monday from 2 to 3. Archived episodes of Write the Book are available on iTunes and at writethebook.podbean.com as free podcasts. And if you have comments or news about book-related events, or if you have a writing prompt that you'd like to suggest to me, please send an email to writethebook@gmail.com. If I choose to use your writing prompt, I will, of course, credit you for it. Please remember that The Radiator is here thanks to community support and involvement, and more information about the station is available online at theradiator.org. So here's the part of the show where I always tell you to stay tuned for Cheryl Willoughby's wonderful show, The World of Music. And I wish I could say that today, but unfortunately for us, Cheryl will not be doing her show here anymore. On the bright side, she is moving on to a terrific opportunity as, I believe it's music director at WGBH in Boston. So that's a fabulous opportunity for Cheryl. I'm sure that we will be seeing great things from her as soon as she joins WGBH, and that's in October. So in the meantime, for now, I'm going to be putting on some great music from the Vermont Music Library, and Write the Book will be back next week at 2 o'clock. Tune in then to hear my interview with David Budbill about his new book, Happy Life. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont.